Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. today. We're continuing our conversation with Marcia Montenegro of Christian Answers for the New Age about feng shui. We'll also be taking your phone calls at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Folks, before we go on, I would love to meet those of you who are listening to us in St. Charles this Sunday. We're having a KFUO Sunday at Trinity Lutheran Church in St. Charles. Pastor Douglas Gaunt is the pastor there. Now, Trinity Lutheran Church is located at 4795 North Highway 94. That's 5 miles north of Highway 370 on Highway 94. Worship begins at 8 and 10. Either service is just as good. I'll also be leading the Bible class at 9:15. So if you're listening to us in St. Charles, stop by Trinity Lutheran Church this Sunday morning for a KFUO Sunday. I'll be preaching during both the 8 and the 10 services and conducting Bible class in between. Larry is calling from Collinsville. Larry, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good afternoon, ma'am and Pastor. Or is that Pastor Honey? Well, we'll just say Pastor. I'm suspecting my wife of practicing feng shui, because she's trying to channel my energy towards housework. Not working. Seriously, she and I are going to California in about 2 weeks, and the place we're going to, the place we'll be staying, offers feng shui haircuts. And I've been thinking about a new do. When it gets long, my locks get kind of curly. So should I do it or not? And actually, if I do it, I've made a decision. When they ask me my birthday, I'm going to give them the day I was baptized.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is a real twist, because I wasn't baptized until I was 25.
Now, Larry, let me just ask you one question. How much is it going to cost you to get a feng shui haircut?
If you have to ask, I forget.
Oh, it's one of those places. All right, Larry, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
Now, there is kind of a serious question here. You go someplace and they say, I'll give you a feng shui haircut. Should a Christian pursue that kind of service?
Well, that's the first time I heard of a feng shui haircut, but I guess that's not too surprising. I think I would want to know what they mean by it. They may just be using the term as a way to jazz up, you know, their haircuts. And if they're just using it that way, that wouldn't bother me. But if they really were using some kind of feng shui principle, you know, I would ask them, what are you basing this on? How are you using feng shui to cut my hair? And then I would make a decision after that. If they wanted any personal information about a birth date or anything, I wouldn't want to give them any date, whether it's my birth date or baptism or whatever, because they would still be using either numerology or some kind of divination. And I don't want to lead anybody into doing something that is against God. And by letting them do it, I might lead them into that. So I would want to make sure they weren't actually going to use feng shui.
And it's just as likely that they're probably just tacking on feng shui because it's a trendy term.
It's very possible, yes. I can't imagine exactly how they're going to apply that, but they might. You know, there could be a way with your birth date or possibly something else about yin and yang. I don't know. It would be interesting to know what they're doing there.
I always thought I had a feng shui haircut. I mean, my hair is cut in such a way as to block no energy whatsoever. It's just, there's just none of it. It's all rounded curves so that chi energy can flow right over the top of my skull. Now, seriously, though, this is kind of like the yoga question. You know, Christians often say yoga is arguably some of the very best stretching and exercise, low-impact kind of exercise a person can engage in. But it's got that pesky connection to the Eastern religions and the same kind of things, the same kind of chi energy things that feng shui and other Eastern religions are connected to. What about feng shui? Someone who says, you know, I found a book and the designs in it are great. I don't buy any of the chi energy stuff, but that living room, I'd like to reproduce that in my living room.
Well, I don't think right now that you can actually separate. I don't think it's just a matter of design. It's not just this is a nice way to design your room. They give you very specific instructions, you know, if you have this door here, then a mirror should be opposite it. And that's not for aesthetic principles. That's not an aesthetic thing at all. It's based on these feng shui principles. So I don't see how a Christian could follow feng shui at all without involving themselves, you know, or without at least following the principles of it, it's just impossible. There's no way to separate it because it doesn't have to do with good design. That's not the point of it. It may result in that accidentally. For example, you know, I point out in my article you balance the yin of flowers with the yang of rocks in a garden. So you have rocks, you know, to balance out the yin energy of the flowers. And that is very nice. Now, just doing that, you know, naturally because it looks nice and it's a nice way to do a garden is one thing. But if you're doing it specifically because that's the advice from Feng Shui based on yin and yang, then that's another thing altogether.
What we're talking about, folks, is Feng Shui. You may have heard about it. It passes itself off in popular circles as merely another way of designing one's home, arranging one's furniture, but behind it lies these ancient and Eastern principles foreign to the Christian worldview of yin and yang, of qi energy, and those who practice feng shui take this stuff very, very seriously. We're talking with Marcia Montenegro. She is a former astrologist, and she's currently director of Christian Answers for the New Age based in Arlington, Virginia. She has an article on the Kana website titled Feng Shui, New Dimensions in Design. If you have a question or a comment or an experience to share on Feng Shui, you can give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You mentioned very briefly in the earlier part of the hour two schools of Feng Shui, and I know these things, I read your article, I know how complex and complicated these things are, but could you kind of describe those two schools for us?
Right. One was the form school that I briefly mentioned earlier, and which is using shapes and colors, and that tends to be something used more, from my understanding, tends to be something used more outside, in an outside landscape. Then there's a very complex method using the eight directions and using a compass. And the compass school, well, let me say something about the form school. They use four mythical animals, the red bird, the black tortoise, the blue dragon, and the white tiger. And these can be, you don't actually have to have something that looks like a black tortoise or a blue dragon, but they're different things from nature, or you can use colors that represent these, and these are supposed to be placed in certain places, like a black tortoise shape or color should be at the back of the building. The compass school is based very much on the flow of qi and uses the trigrams of the I Ching. Now, some people may have heard of the I Ching, which is basically, well, which has become a divinatory system. And I used to know people that did the I Ching and got I Ching consultations. It's a lot like numerology or astrology. It's a form of divination. Now, the trigrams are unbroken and broken lines. And there's three lines representing heaven, earth, and man, because in the ancient Chinese view of everything had to be balanced between heaven, earth, and man. These were the basic three things of the universe as they saw it. And so Feng Shui kind of came out of this too, trying to harmonize these three things. And the way you do this is you use these trigrams, these little shapes, which represent heaven, earth, and man, and they're subdivided into 64 hexagrams, and they come into different patterns, and they are supposed to represent patterns, the patterns of change in the energies around us, and so you use that to determine the best pattern. That's the best way of explaining it without getting very technical, because it's really technical. So the compass school has that element of it. And then even within the compass school, there are different things you can do. One is where you use a 24-point compass, which determines the type of yin and yang flowing in certain directions. There's something else called a bagua, or the nine palaces, which shows the lucky and unlucky areas, which can be discerned through birth dates. And there's something called a pakwa, which is an eight-sided grid. That also has to do with the eight directions of the compass. That's like north, northeast, east, southeast, south, southwest, and west, northwest. So those are the basic eight directions, and four positive and four negative. And by using your birth date, then supposedly you determine which of the directions are positive for you in your location and which are negative. And then you base what you're going to do on that.
I try and think of these things in terms of their lowest common denominator, and I hope I'm not oversimplifying when I ask, is this essentially feng shui and these astrology as well, are these essentially superstition at their base? A man's belief that through whatever he does in his world or his environment around him, he can manipulate essentially the divine.
Yeah, I would say yes, that's true. It's a basic belief in manipulating things so that the positive things will come your way. You know, things will be more positive for me if I follow this principle and harmonize this and do this, and then things will flow better, and then I will get the positive results. Yeah, I think that you could use the term superstition for that.
Is the Western practice of feng shui, as it's becoming more popular, has it begun to take on kind of the Western New Age baggage as well? Kind of the intermixing, the eclectic nature of the New Age movement in America?
Yes, and that was, of course, inevitable that would happen. I wanted to say real quickly early when you asked me about the history of feng shui, and I sort of blanked out because there really isn't any good history of it, but I did want to mention that it did start, according to my sources, with determining the best place to build a grave. So it started around the ideas of where to build a grave, because the idea of ancestor contact was very important and in some of the animistic religions. And so building a grave and where to place the grave for your ancestors is very important. And that was where it originally began, according to what I read. The New Age ideas, for example, one of them that I came across was there were instructions for how to meet the spirit of your home. And the spirit could manifest as a person, an animal, a voice, or just a presence. So this was supposed to be a way where you get to know the spirit of your home, and you know, and then you can, I assume from that you would know better how you should live in that home because of this knowing the spirit, kind of getting familiar with him, I guess. You could also chant Om, which is the Hindu sacred sound, and that's been around in the New Age for a while. And you visualize the symbol of Om, which looks like a big, probably people have seen it and not realized what it is. It looks like a kind of a number three, and then there's some more to it, but it's basically that's what it kind of looks like. And you visualize that symbol and then implant that symbol's energy into the atmosphere of your home. So there are some new age elements that have started creeping into it, and I'm sure feng shui would probably be classified, generally speaking, under the New Age.
Now, with something so complex and something that is increasingly westernized, I imagine that sooner or later someone's going to come up with a feng shui for dummies book, you know, like they have computers for dummies or Windows for dummies.
Yeah, there may even be one. You know, I don't know if I've checked on that. I wouldn't be surprised if there already was one.
What is the proper Christian understanding? What does the Christian do with feng shui, if anything? How are they to view it? What are the dangers?
I think that, first of all, we have to be aware that this is not just principles of good decorating. That is not what it's about, even if some of the results are that way. So we have to really be aware of that. Secondly, of course, not to to be condemning towards it in the sense of, oh, you know, that's evil, I'm not going to talk to anybody who does that or anybody who wants to do that. But to realize that these principles are antithetical to the Christian worldview and to the Bible, and not to participate in it. It's not something, I know it can be seen in a very lighthearted way because it has to do with, in the minds of most people, with decorating your home, and that just seems very superficial to people. But when the actual principles are looked at, they're a lot more than that, and because they're based on this ki and the idea of using divination, it's really a way to get information and figure out how you're going to live your life so that positive things come to you. So there's an idea there that you are manipulating or controlling things by doing this, which is, of course, antithetical to the biblical worldview as well. So I think Christians should not, you know, participate in this. I got an interesting email from, I've gotten a few emails from people who told me that they were going to use feng shui and then they read my article and decided not to. These were Christians. One of them was a woman who had actually gone ahead and hired a feng shui consultant. And she said she started feeling a little uneasy about it, even though she didn't know that much about it. But the person came to her home. I guess they looked around or whatever, and then they told her how much it would cost, and they told her the money had to be put in red envelopes because red envelopes are considered to be auspicious and it's good for money. So and positive. In other words, they will fight off negative energy. So they wanted her to put the money in red envelopes, and they told her a few other things that struck her as very strange. And so she started looking for information on feng shui and came across my article and read it. And then she emailed me and she said, I canceled the thing, a whole thing. I decided not to do it. She said, when they told me they wanted the money in red envelopes, she said, I knew there was something wrong there, and I didn't want to participate in this. And so she, you know, she didn't do it. Because really, I mean, you are a participant in it. If you hire a feng shui person or use the principles, you're participating in it. I don't see how it's different from going to an astrologer.
And you talk in your article about the, what you call it, psychological bondage to the design of your home. What do you mean?
Yeah, because you actually can't just put things where you want them or where you think they might look good. You have to think about all these very detailed things. For example, you're supposed to have an even number of chairs in your dining room because they're lucky. Your stove should be positioned towards the east and southeast of the kitchen because that's the direction of the wood element. Now, if your stove isn't positioned that way, it might cost a lot of money to change it. You should not flush the toilet with the lid open, okay? Now, that would be kind of a pain to constantly close the lid all the time because that means that the energy it has to do with your money might go down the toilet. You're supposed to hang curtains at the bottom of stairs. And to help ki go flow up the stairs, you should put plants under the stairs or hang art that is light and bright around the stairs to help the ki rise. You should not have a straight sidewalk or driveway because there's bad ki and good ki, and straight lines attract the bad ki, and curved lines attract the good ki.
And I tell you what, my house is not passing the test. We got a lot of bad key.
You have a straight driveway.
I got straight everything, and all the furniture's in the wrong place.
Uh-oh.
It's all arranged so we can see the TV, and that's probably not good feng shui.
Probably not.
What about this concept of luck, fate, destiny? Does that have any place in the Christian worldview?
And, of course, that which is a big part of feng shui, it has no place at all in the Christian worldview because here you're actually doing things based on the idea that you're going to be lucky. Well, what is luck when you really think about it? Luck is basically from old, you know, probably religious ideas that you're getting the favor of the gods or somehow accessing something that is going to bring something good to you, whether it's money or love or success, and you're going to do something to get that coming your way. Through an object or through whatever it is that you're doing. And so that whole idea of thinking you are going to bring something your way, first of all, is denying the idea of a sovereign God. Secondly, of course, you're not placing yourself in God's will and allowing Him to lead you into what He wants you to do, but you yourself are determining what should be good for you and then going after it. And, of course, the idea of luck, how can there even be such a thing as good luck or bad luck? That's seeing things in terms of a very material kind of superficial way of, I was really lucky and this happened to me, rather than, wow, you know, this wonderful thing happened to me today. God allowed this to enter my life. So luck is just cannot at all be part of the biblical worldview.
And this notion of the key energy or this energy force throughout the universe, this life force, any common ground with the Christian worldview?
And that certainly does not have any common ground. Unfortunately, what I'm seeing, mostly through alternative health practices, is an acceptance of key beginning to happen in the Christian community. They are doing is trying to Christianize ki and call it the Holy Spirit. Or in one case, somebody who emailed me said, well, ki could be the breath of God. Now, this is amazing to me that Christians are wanting to accept the idea of ki, or they try to redefine it in scientific terms. But this is a something from a spiritual belief, and the way it's used in these philosophies has nothing to do with science. It all has to do with spiritual benefits. And so how can you believe in a force that you can access and manipulate? How does that fit into the Bible? There's nothing in the Bible that indicates that we should access that kind of force or energy, or even that it exists. My personal view on ki is that it is Satan's counterfeit to the Holy Spirit. And that's how I see it. It's his counterfeit to the Holy Spirit, and it is not from God at all.
So would you be conceding that there is actually objectively something such as ki, or are you saying that the teaching of ki is a counterfeit teaching?
Well, I do think the teaching is a counterfeit teaching. Whether there is ki or not is probably up for debate. It's probably one of those in-house debate things, like is there really supernatural power in the occult? I have my own views on that. I believe that theoretically, no, ki does not exist the way it is taught. However, I do believe that people can experience something that they think is ki when they indulge in certain practices. It will be a certain kind of feeling, some kind of energy that they will think is ki, and I personally think that's an occult power.
So would you place feng shui as it would be classically practiced? Someone who has bought into the notions and the presuppositions behind it, would you place it in the realm of the occult?
Yes, I think yes, definitely, absolutely. I think it is an occult practice. It would probably be put under New Age in this country because it in other ways it falls under New Age. But I tend to see the New Age as part of the occult anyway. But I would say that technically, it, just like astrology, it's based on occult principles.
Marcia Montenegro, thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, thank you for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Folks, if you're looking for one of the only resources out there on feng shui that won't simply tell you how to do it or that it's a good idea, you really want to check out the website for Christian Answers for the New Age. There's an article there by our guest, Marcia Montenegro. It's called Feng Shui, New Dimensions in Design. She's not going to explain to you how to make your house more aesthetic. She will talk to you about the dangers, the history, and the genuine nature of feng shui. You can check it out by going to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. We have a section called Links with Regular Guests. When you click on that, you're going to find a link to Marcia Montenegro and Christian Answers for the New Age. Our website address again, issuesetc.org. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Dr. Elizabeth Loftus. There's a new study out. Boy, if there was ever a conversation to put Issues Etc. on the map, it was the conversation on recovered memory therapy. If you're an old-time Issues Etc. fan, you can remember the days when that was a regular subject of conversation. Well, we will revisit it when we come back from this break. There's a new study on recovered memory therapy. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues Etc.
our culture. It's now like the Greeks.
Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Bible Upholding Ministry of Answers in Genesis. Well, Ken, what do you mean by saying our society is now like the Greeks?
There's no doubt that America was once a great Christian nation. In fact, years ago, the Bible was taught in its public schools. Prayer and teaching of the Ten Commandments were a part of the daily school program, and most people respected the Bible. They understood the meaning of sin and knew about Jesus Christ. In other words, like the Jews, the foundation of the gospel was inherent in American society. That's why evangelists could preach about sin and repentance and see thousands come to Christ. But things are very different today in America and many other once Christianized nations. By and large, the Bible and prayer are not allowed in government schools. Evolution is taught as fact. Today, when evangelists preach the message of sin and repentance, there's an increasing number of people who don't understand what they're hearing. They're like the Greek society that had no foundation for the gospel. To reach these people with the gospel, we need to follow Paul's example in Acts 17. We should oppose their evolutionary ideas and explain about the true God and the origin of sin by starting with the beginning in Genesis.
Ken Ham can show you how to use dinosaurs as witnessing tools, starting from the Bible's Book of Beginnings, Genesis. This eye-opening booklet on dinosaurs can be read on your computer screen when you go to AnswersRadio.com. In fact, use the booklet as a witnessing tool. It's a free service of AnswersRadio.com.
There may already be women pregnant with cloned human embryos.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Credible reports indicate that scientists have already impregnated women with cloned human embryos and that the birth of a cloned human baby is imminent. If it's not true now, the possibility is not far off. While most people oppose live birth cloning, all cloning involves a degradation and oftentimes destruction of human life. We must draw a line in the sand to stop all human cloning before it goes too far.
The Susan B. Anthony List is dedicated to supporting pro-life legislation, training candidates and activists, and promoting pro-life leaders. To view all this month's commentaries, visit our website at sba-list.org. That's sba-list.org.
Today, if you are among the many who have no one to call Lord, let us carry you to the Christ. To those of you who have forgotten the Lord who died to set you free, let us carry you to Him who died so that you might live forgiven and free. The Christ who gave His life upon Calvary's cruel cross is compassion.
Hear Pastor Ken Klaus this week on the Lutheran Hour. Sundays at 12:30 and 5 p.m.
Welcome back. In the next 25 minutes of Issues Etc., we're going to have two guests for you. We're going to be talking with Dr. Elizabeth Loftus to begin with. There's a new study on recovered memory therapy, and it was one of the things, back when Don Matzett was host of this program, he talked an awful lot about recovered memory therapy, especially as it was being applied to all sorts of abuse cases and things like that, although it's not unique to that. One of the things that recovered memory therapy is used for, if you remember a recent conversation that we had on UFOs, is the recovery of memories from abductions or encounters with aliens. And there are doctors out there who will take you through the recovered memory therapy, and sometimes you remember things you didn't remember before, and people will say, how does this work? Are these memories genuine? We're going to talk about that during this first part of the last half hour of Issues Etc. Now tomorrow, on Issues Etc., a six-day creation will be our subject. Dr. David Adams of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis will be our guest. Does day mean day in Genesis chapter 1 and 2? Or does it mean epoch? Does it mean era? Does it mean millennia? What does it mean? What does the text seem to say? We'll also talk about racial segregation in the church. Uwe Simonetto of United Press International will be our guest. There are those who have said that the most segregated hour in America is Sunday morning. And Dr. Norman Nagel joins us tomorrow on the program also to talk about why we go to church. He's Professor Emeritus of Systematic Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Sunday night on the program, Biblical Archaeology. This is one of my favorite guests. Dr. Paul Meyer of Western Michigan University will be with us Sunday night on Issues Etc. We're going to talk about biblical archaeology, something that is near and dear to his heart. He is a professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University, author of many books, and we've talked to him many times. Now, if you've got a question or a comment on biblical archaeology, I really want to know what you want me to ask him on Sunday night, and you can do that by going to our Issues Etc. forum, posting your question, your comment on biblical archaeology right there on the forum. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and there you're going to find a link to the Issues Etc. forum. Post your question or your comment there in advance of Sunday night's program, and I'll see if we can have Dr. Paul Meyer answer it live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. We're going to talk about recovered memory therapy. Our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, is cognitive psychologist and distinguished professor of social ecology at the University of California in Irvine. She presented a research paper last Sunday to the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The paper was titled Remembering Traumatic Experiences in Childhood, Reliability and Limitations of Memory. Dr. Loftus, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you.
Tell us about your study, and, well, first of all, tell us about the claims of recovered memory therapy.
Oh, actually, what's been going on for the last 10 years or so, or even more, is that there have been people who go into therapy. They've got one set of problems. They're depressed. Maybe they aren't that interested in sex right now. Maybe they have an eating disorder. And they end up with a therapist who says something like, everyone I've seen with those symptoms was sexually abused as a child. I wonder if this happened to you. And even though the patient says no and doesn't have any memories, the therapist presses with techniques like imagination or guided imagery or dream interpretation, sometimes hypnosis. And you end up with somebody who begins to remember years and years of brutalization that allegedly was repressed in the into the unconscious. And that's the kind of situation that I and others have been so concerned about throughout the last decade.
Now, when you talk about guided memory therapy or regression, what exactly are those techniques?
It's a little different depending on who's doing it, but you know, one form takes looks like this. You say to the patient, oh, you don't remember anybody abusing you. Let's just close your eyes and imagine who might have done it and where might it have happened. And sometimes that imagination can be, and this is what some of these studies are showing, the first step down that royal road to developing a false memory.
What is the nature of the study on the new study on recovered memory therapy?
Well, I actually talked about three different studies that are not yet published. The first one that I talked about was a study that was done with Veronika Nerkova, a Russian psychology professor, and my colleague Dan Bernstein. And what we did is we planted a false detail into the memories of Russian citizens for a bombing of a building that had occurred in September of 1999. This was, you can think of this as the kind of Russian version of the World Trade Center. It was a horrible, tragic event. 233 people died. And we suggested to people that they had seen a wounded animal in the post-event viewings of this tragedy, when in fact there never was a wounded animal shown anywhere. We succeeded with about 12.5% of our subjects getting them to believe and report on this wounded animal that never even existed. And they could be quite detailed to say something like a bleeding cat lying in the dust.
So in other words, you use the very techniques that are under suspicion, that are being used for people in therapist's office to get people to recover memory.
Well, in that particular study, we used a technique that was a fairly strong form of suggestion. Not exactly like we asked a leading question. We essentially said to the subject, when we interviewed you 6 months ago, you mentioned this wounded animal. Do you remember it now? So we told them, in essence, that they had told us about it before, which wasn't true. So that's a kind of a strong suggestion. It's not exactly like what you'd see in therapy. But in some of the other studies I talked about, we did use techniques that are close to what goes on in some therapy sessions. So I'll give you an example, because one of them involves the work of In fact, my former doctoral student, Ayanna Thomas, who's now a postdoc at Wash U, and our collaborator, John Bulovich, who is a graduate student at Wash U now, but when we were working together in my lab, we used imagination as a way, guided imagination as a way to contaminate people's memories. And using guided imagination, we got a significant minority of people to tell us they did things that they didn't do 2 weeks ago, things that would even have been a little bit bizarre if they had done them, like kissing a frog or crushing a Hershey's Kiss with a dental floss container.
You're kidding.
No, I mean, the way these studies work is we just have people interacting with objects on a table, and later on they are led through, about a day later, they were led through some guided imagination. So imagine kissing the frog, imagine the feel of the frog on your lips, imagine the color of the frog, and taking people through multiple imaginations like that does lead to people telling you they did things they didn't do, even bizarre things.
They will tell you with a straight face that they know they've been guided through these imagination exercises, they will tell you they did it.
They say they did it, about 15% of the time, roughly.
Now, what does this tell you about the nature and the reliability of human memory?
These particular three new studies that I talked about at the scientific meeting last weekend in Denver are studies that really extend our knowledge of the malleability of memory. They show us, for example, that traumatic memories are not immune from contamination. You can deliberately contaminate somebody's memory for a true trauma. They show us that you can make people believe that they did things that would have been a little bit bizarre if they actually had done them. And in one of the other studies that I didn't mention, we made people believe things that were impossible. They couldn't have occurred, like shaking hands with Bugs Bunny at Disneyland.
Tell us about that one.
Well, in that particular line of work, we exposed people to an advertisement, a fake ad, and this particular ad for Disney features Bugs Bunny. You see a picture of him, you know, sitting in a chair near the Magic Castle and so on. There's text in the ad that talks about how running into Bugs Bunny and having him shake your hand was the highlight of your trip. And after evaluating this ad and looking at it for a while, we asked people about their own experiences at Disney, and we found in this new study that with multiple presentations of the ad, that over 30% of our subjects claimed they met Bugs Bunny at Disney. And since Bugs is a Warner Brothers character, of course, he wouldn't be walking around the grounds at Disney.
That would be copyright infringement, I believe.
Right. Right. So we're really extending our knowledge of just how distortions could creep into memory. I think the lesson here is that we need to have a healthy skepticism about memory. We need to recognize that faulty memory is a major cause for wrongful convictions in this society, and maybe be a little bit more careful.
I am I'm intrigued by, you talked about the commercial with Bugs Bunny, and I'm intrigued then by what you might believe the media's potential is to, even on a grand scale, I'm not talking about conspiracy theories here, but even on a grand scale, manipulate, even unintentionally, memories of events, because everything that we see in the media, by way of big news, is all edited, it's all carefully put together for time and things like that. Do you have similar concerns?
Well, absolutely. I mean, for example, when some witness to an event is interviewed and there's a lot of media exposure to that interview, you find other people will pick up the information uttered by that one first witness, and you have, in some sense, mass contamination, you know, a big, giant memory distortion experiment on a national scale. I mean, that's the kind of thing that happened, for example, in the Oklahoma bombing case, when everybody was looking for John Doe number two, who never existed, but one witness said so. Or after the TWA-800 crash, where one witness gets on the media and starts talking about seeing missiles, and pretty soon you have a whole bunch of people saying they saw missiles, and you have the missile conspiracy theory.
And I imagine it would extend to the crash of Columbia. You know, what did I see on television, and what did I actually see when I looked up in the sky, kind of a thing?
Yeah, you can mix those memories up. It's very normal, and it would be very expected.
I was a little, when I was little, I had all sorts of interesting experiences as a child, and there are always these family stories that we tell when we get together. And my brothers give me no end of grief because my memories are always notoriously inaccurate.
Wow.
And they're always cobbled together from everyone else's stories. And my brothers, who have better memory than I do, will always tell me that never happened.
Well,
that's that you put two stories together or something like that. And I've learned not to rely on especially my own childhood memory. I have distinct memories of doing things that my brothers and my parents tell me, you didn't do that. You weren't even born yet.
Oh, dear. Well, so this all seems very familiar to you.
But you catch a lot of criticism from the recovered memory crowd, don't you?
Oh, I do. Yeah, they've been out to get me for years.
Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, thank you so much for being our guest. Keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you very much.
Dr. Elizabeth Loftus is cognitive psychologist and distinguished professor of social ecology at the University of California, Irvine. She presented a research paper last Sunday to the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The paper was titled Remembering Traumatic Experiences in Childhood, Reliability and Limitations of Memory. Also presenting a paper at that same Association for the Advancement of Science is our next guest, Dr. Richard McNally, professor of psychology at Harvard University. We're going to talk about recovered memories and alleged abduction by space aliens. Dr. McNally, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello.
What is the nature of your research into recovered memory therapy?
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist who's done laboratory research for a number of years on people who have reported memories of childhood sexual abuse after long periods of time not having thought about them. Some of our research studies, however, were somewhat difficult to interpret because we were uncertain whether the recovered memories of early trauma were genuine, which I believe they are in many cases, but also in other cases not genuine. So accordingly, we began to do some research on people who'd recovered memories of trauma that we're pretty sure did not happen. This is the work on people who believe they've been abducted by space aliens.
What was the nature of the research? What were the results as well?
Of the space alien one?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the study that I presented at the American Association for Advancement of Science was one done with my colleagues designed to answer the question, do people who have recovered memories of traumatic events that probably didn't happen, do those individuals exhibit the physiological signs of intense emotion in the laboratory when they remember these memories, as do people who've actually been exposed to events such as combat and who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD? That was the question we had. The way we went about answering it was using what is called a script-driven imagery procedure, standard procedure in post-traumatic stress disorder research, where we asked the subject to write down a narrative of the traumatic event, in this case, abduction by aliens, and then also write down brief narratives of other neutral, positive, and other stressful events. We then take these narratives and convert them into 30-second audio tapes. We play these narratives of the memories back to the subject in the laboratory while we measure their psychophysiologic responses, such as heart rate, increases in heartbeat, sweat gland activity on the palm of the hands. We have monitors attached to the subject to measure the physiology. What we found, much to our surprise, was that the reactions of the quote-unquote space alien abductees when recalling their memories as prompted by the audio tapes were quite marked. Their heart rate went up. The sweating on the palm of the hands went up. They showed the signs that are very similar to those of people who've been exposed to traumatic events and have PTSD.
What does this tell you, then, by way of gauging the accuracy of memories?
Well, first of all, I think what it tells us is our results underscore the power of emotional belief. These individuals sincerely believe these sorts of things happened to them. When they first recovered these memories, they were quite distressed by them, and when they recollect them now, they show the physiological signs of intense emotion. I don't think, however, that you can use the physiological data to distinguish between true and false memories, because what essentially you have here is that if you sincerely believe these events happened, and they were frightening at the time, then you show the same reactions as does a genuine trauma survivor.
Does the is there something about writing it down, putting it into a narrative, or retelling a memory, even if the memory is false, that reinforces the false memory?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of reinforcing the false memory per se. I think that when these people recollect these early experiences that they describe, and when they hear them described to them in the laboratory and through the audio tape, it just provokes these early emotional memories.
Now, you mentioned early in our conversation that you do believe that a segment of recovered memories are, in fact, genuine. What conclusions would you draw on the basis of your research about the things that could have happened, like the sexual molestation, laying aside the issue of abduction by space aliens?
Well, let me be clear about one thing right after the bat, is that we're continuing to do research on people who report histories of childhood sexual abuse. Working with my student Susan Clancy, our former PhD student, who's our postdoc here now, we have learned that there really are two groups of people that have been lumped together by the media, by the courts, by other scientists and clinicians as recovered memory subjects. We have one group of individuals who we found who reported being molested as kids, having experiences with fondling and other types of non-violent sexual abuse like that. At the time the events occurred, they were often experienced as frightening but not terrifying, upsetting but not traumatic. They were puzzling. The kids didn't know what to make of them. Then the perpetrator died or they moved to a new neighborhood. And for many years, these individuals didn't think about these events. They sort of just put them out of their mind, didn't know what to do with them. And then many years later, they're reminded of these events, such as, for example, turning on the local news and hearing about the local scandal about the Boston Archdiocese. And then suddenly these things pop into mind again. However, the key point here is that when people have been traumatized and the events are terrifying when they first occur, people seldom forget about them. If they're upsetting or puzzling, they're not sure what to make of them, sometimes they don't think about them for many years and then are later reminded of them. That's what I mean by the cases that seem to be more convincing. This is not about repression or amnesia. I mean, we can't equate not thinking about something for a long period of time with an inability to remember it.
So it would be similar to a memory that I would not have had of something in my childhood had it not been, had, say, my mother not reminded me, do you remember? Well, it happened to me recently. My mother said, do you remember when you broke your toe?
Mm-hmm.
And if no one would have said to me, do you remember when you broke your toe, I probably would have gone to my grave never remembering that I broke my toe when I was a kid.
Unless reminded of it.
Yeah, she simply reminded, and it all came right back to me.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. Yeah, so many of the cases that we've been working with recently in our laboratory fit that profile. The other group, on the other hand, are those who've sometimes come into therapists distressed or depressed about different things. The therapist says, oh my goodness, you have all the signs of someone who harbors repressed memories of abuse. Let us hypnotize you and try to uncover these memories and so on and so forth. And then these folks sometimes come up with these scenarios. Unfortunately, both of these get lumped together as recovered memory cases. And I think the circumstances of the memory recovery are very different in both cases.
Do you have deep suspicions about the second category of recovered memory?
Well, certainly the second category, when the person is asked about whether these things ever happen, and they say, no, I don't think so, and then they begin to worry about it, they undergo certain risky therapeutic procedures, these fragmentary memories or quote-unquote memories begin to surface, I'd be much more suspicious of those cases being legitimate than in the first cases, the one that's more akin to your damaged toe.
Now, is this something on the wane? My suspicion, or at least as I've observed this thing, in the late 90s, it was really in vogue for therapists to start delving into repressed memories, but I don't hear so much about it lately. What is your sense about that?
Well, it's really difficult to tell. I mean, what happened in the mid and late 90s is that there was, as you know, a big controversy associated with this. But at the time the controversy was occurring, there was not a great deal of research on the topic. Since then, in the last, say, from mid-90s onward, there has been quite a bit of research on the topic. It's waned from the nation's headlines somewhat. It's hard to tell whether it has, in fact, changed therapeutic practices. I suspect it probably has in many cases. I think many therapists are more aware of how memory can be distorted and are more careful than they used to be. But I have no data to back that up. It's just simply a suspicion.
What is your research and the other research that you heard presented at the American Association for the Advancement of Science tell you about the nature of memory and the reliability of memory?
Well, I think, a key theme that emerged from not only that conference or that symposium and other research on this, is that when memories are genuinely traumatic when they occur. When they're emotionally intense memories, you're more likely to remember them and less likely to forget them. However, even emotionally intense memories are not like videotapes. They can, in fact, be altered and change over time. So although the person will retain the gist or the essence of the memory quite vividly, if it was traumatic when it first occurred and they seldom forget it, it's not as if these memories are not malleable, not changeable.
Finally, how would you respond to one of an alleged victim who says, look, this was my experience, it is true for me, you weren't there, you cannot disprove my experience?
What do you mean, true for me? You mean, so they're reporting...
Well, they're simply saying, this is my experience, and who are you to gainsay any experience I had, say the alien abduction?
Oh, yes, right. Well, in the case of the alien abduction cases, in fact, this is exactly what these folks are saying, the alien abduction memories are very different from the sexual abuse memories in one extremely, well, actually several aspects, one very important aspect. When we interviewed the people with the alien abduction memories, they all described episodes of apparent sleep paralysis plus hypnopompic upon awakening hallucinations that got this thing going for them. This is not the case with the child abuse cases at all. So I think there's another very vivid explanation for the alien abduction memory. So what happens here is that the person begins to awaken from rapid eye movement sleep. That's when you do your dreaming, and when your body is completely paralyzed. You don't know that, of course, when you're dreaming because you're asleep. But they begin to awaken, but the muscular paralysis is still in effect, and they begin to awaken, and they are dreaming with their eyes open, so to speak, and so they'll witness lights flashing in the room, see intruders in the bedroom and the like, which then is misinterpreted as aliens. And so this forms the basis of that experience, that sleep abnormality is a genuine experience that gets them rolling on this path. So that's legitimate. That happened, but then they misinterpret it.
Dr. Richard McNally, thank you very much for being our guest, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Richard McNally is professor of psychology at Harvard University. He presented a research paper last Sunday to the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Before we go, folks, let me remind you, this Sunday, KFUO Sunday at Trinity Lutheran Church in St. Charles, the service times, I'll be preaching there and doing Bible class in between 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock. Bible class is in between. I'd love to see our listeners out in St. Charles. Come and visit us there. Pastor Richard Gaunt would also, Doug Gaunt would also like to see you there as well. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be talking about a six-day creation with Dr. David Adams, racial segregation in the church with Uwe Simonetto of United Press International, and Dr. Norman Nagel joins us from Concordia Seminary to answer the question, why go to church? That's all tomorrow on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Today's Issues Etc. broadcast was partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, testing the claims of church growth. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month, testing the claims of church growth.